They come from the bowels of hell.
The Dana Gould Hour.
Jungle worms and swamp rats run around your feet.
I bought a dog that killed the calf that ate the canary. What is truth?
And once again, welcome back.
Well, things have certainly been interesting, haven't they? The events of the past several weeks have been, I think it's safe to say, historic and important. I'm not exactly sure where comedy podcasts fit in, but we'll muddle through best we can. You know, this was a perfect storm. You had the effects of the lockdown with everybody cooped up for a long time. Everybody's insecure about economics and their health. The proliferation of cell phone videos pulling back the veil on systemic police brutality. As Will Smith said, racism isn't getting worse, it's getting filmed. And then we had the 1-2-3 of Breonna Taylor, Aubrey Adams, and George Floyd. Now you have a tinderbox. And with a pyromaniac for a president, the results have been sadly predictable, and in this country, sadly unavoidable. But it looks like some good may come of it, so fingers crossed. Now, a lot of people are saying, defund the police. Some are saying, abolish the police. That's not going to happen. I am of the opinion that the first, most important step is to demilitarize the police. Now, what we know as the police in America is, by and large, a relatively new invention. It's certainly much younger than the country is. The original version of the police were groups formed to protect shipping and catch runaway slaves. So yeah, you're already off to a bad start. Then these forces were employed largely by politicians and were used primarily to bust up workers that were thinking of going on strike. They were also there to eyeball the shifty immigrants who were flooding our cities. You know, creepy, foreign-looking types from exotic, un-American places like Ireland, Italy, and Germany. People who were considered strange because they drank in taverns instead of at home. The police were often employed by political machines at the time and were routinely used to harass and intimidate voters for their likely opposition, and to turn a blind eye to things like prostitution and other crimes when those particular crimes provided kickbacks to said politicians, etc., etc. Now, in 1929, President Hoover formed the Wickersham Commission to study just how corrupt and ineffective local police were. One of the solutions that came out of that commission was that police precincts were redrawn so that they didn't correspond with whatever council member or alderman ran that district, lessening the possibility of political corruption. And so began the professionalism of America's police force. The downside of it, what we're dealing with now, is that departments became inward-looking and isolated from the public. This took a terrible turn in 1997, when the Pentagon initiated a boneheaded undertaking, the 1033 program. This allowed the military to pass on excess equipment to law enforcement. All they have to pay for is shipping. So you have a police force in a medium-sized American city, say, Ferguson. And suddenly, they're outfitted as if they're storming Fallujah. And guess what? When you dress people up like they're in the army, they naturally start behaving as if they're at war. And this underlines the fundamental argument that we are now facing as we define what police departments across the country will look like as we go into the 21st century. What is the job of the police? To enforce the law or keep the peace? The hope is that the police can step away from their military footing, as they have in experimental programs, like in Camden, New Jersey, where the police department was disbanded and rebuilt from the ground up, with a greater emphasis on community involvement, and a greater number of minority hires to make the local police department actually resemble the population that it's policing. Camden moved to make the police partners with the citizens in the community in which they were enforcing the law. Anyway, we will see. One thing for sure, things are not going to go back to the way they were. What if the police just stopped murdering people? How about that? Maybe we make it illegal for them to point their gun at you unless you're pointing your gun at them. What about that? Just a thought. Anyway, look, my oldest brother was a cop when I was a kid, so I know how to talk to cops. I'm also an Anglo-Saxon white male. I am Mr. Fucking Privilege. But even I have had distasteful encounters with the LAPD, some of whom, too many of whom, behave like soldiers of an occupying army more than members of a community trying to maintain law and order. In 1994, I was walking out of a video store on La Brea Avenue called Rocket Video. Remember video stores? Get in my car, shut the door, roll down the window, and I stick my head out to look at La Brea behind me so I can pull my car out. I stick my head out the window, I turn around, and I look into the barrel of a pistol. And there's a guy standing there, and he says, "Hello, my name is Hugo. Give me your money or I'll shoot you." I was so cooperative. Gave him my wallet. Gave him my... That was it. He just wanted the wallet. Gave him a couple jokes. Gave him some bits to work on. And then he left. And then I I was freaked out. And then I went to the Hollywood station of the LAPD to report it. And the two cops on the desk were these two, you know, muscle-bound guys about my age. You know, late 20s, early 30s. But these guys were huge. Two chuckleheads. And I tell him what happened, and the guy's like, "What kind of gun is it?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I don't know guns." And he goes, "Was it like this?" And he takes his service revolver out of his holster, and he sticks it in my face. The second gun I've had in my face in an hour. His buddy thinks it's hilarious. He starts laughing. And I said, "No, it wasn't." And then I waited, and I said, and he didn't giggle. Well, they fucking hated that. The fact that I didn't go along with their little game of let's humiliate the crime victim. And they glared at me for a full 30 seconds, whips out a form, starts firing off questions. "Oh, don't know his name. Don't know what he looked like. Okay, all right." And then he gets to the end of the form. He's like, "Well, what are we supposed to do?" The point is, I understand that being a police officer is a very difficult job, but if affording people their basic human dignity is the hardest part of your job, maybe you're too fucked up to be on the police department. Now, my guest today is a very good friend of the show and a co-host of one of my favorite podcasts, Hacks on Tap, which is a weekly political roundup that he co-hosts with David Axelrod. Mike Murphy is a political strategist, a Republican never-Trumper, and a great guy. This interview was recorded before the spate of riots and social unrest, so that topic is not broached, but we did cover the pandemic and the election. What I love about Mike's analysis is that he has a baseball coach's approach to elections because he used to run campaigns. He gets right down into the nuts and bolts of what you need to do to win, because if you don't win, you don't get to do what you want, and that's the truth, Ruth. Two things before I get going. You all know about our Patreon. Go to danagould.com, click on the link. We don't have 15 different levels. We have one. Send me $5 a month, and you get access to a bunch of cool shit, bonus audio, video, links. You get the title Dana Gould, Our Sky Cadet. Now, one of the projects that we're working on is to catalog and feature all of the True Tales from Weirdsville Middle Pieces, going back to the beginning of the podcast. They will all be there indexed and available for your listening pleasure. Last but not least, I'll Be Gone in the Dark will be premiering on HBO on June 28th. It's a 6-part true crime series that documents Michelle McNamara's virtually single-handed hunt for the Golden State Killer prior to her tragic and sudden passing in 2016. Now, not long after Michelle's death, Her work helped lead the police to the Golden State Killer, who had been lying dormant for decades, and he is now in prison, where he belongs. Michelle was a guest on this podcast on the April of 2013 episode, talking about her investigation. Michelle was a really good buddy of mine. As I'm sure you know, she was Mrs. Patton Oswalt. And if you'd like to hear that interview, go to danagould.com, go to the podcast library, and look up the April 2013 episode, which is entitled Murder, Etc. And there it is. That is some filthy business, folks. And now, let's get on to ours. We are in the first official day of the modified easing of the safe at home restrictions here in California, and I don't know what that means. But we are joined by a very good friend of mine, good friend of the podcast. Please welcome the lovely and talented, funny lady, Mike Murphy.
Dana, good to be here, and thank you for that overblown and undeserved introduction.
Now, we should get right out of the way. You have one of my favorite podcasts, Hacks on Tap. Tell a little bit about, talk to the people about Hacks on Tap. If my listeners don't listen to it, I highly recommend it.
Well, thank you. So, you know, I'm a right-wing Republican nut, and I'm a political consultant. At least I was. I don't really do campaigns anymore. But
you really
time,
no, let me stop you right there. Let me Chris Matthews you right there, since Chris Matthews isn't around to do it anymore.
Compliment me on my strapless dress first. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. By today's standards, you're a moderate. You know,
well, I like hate to think Trump.
I think of you and I as sort of the opposite sides of the same coin, in that I'm a very liberal progressive, but I know the country that I live in, and I know the difference between possible and pie in the sky. And so I tend to be a little more moderate, and I think that you seem to be the other side of the same coin.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, the Republican Party's gone bananas. I'm not a populist. I'm a snide tuxedo wearing elitist here, good old fashioned Republican.
You were the model for community chest in Monopoly.
Yeah, exactly. So I've been anti-Trump since '93. When I was running politics for the governor of New Jersey, Christine Todd Whitman, I'd run both her campaigns, and we had to deal with him as he stained his way through Atlantic City, and he was just such a thug and a grifter.
Oh, really? So you go back to him that
far? Yeah, and I'm wondering where all these Johnny Come Latelys are from. You know, I was early on the put Trump in a lead box cage and let him stay there. But to get to Hacks on Tap, available on iTunes, radio.com, and all podcasting platforms, my old buddy David Axelrod, who, like you, is a fellow traveler of Marx and Lenin, he's still a good friend.
And for those of you
who
don't know who he is, he was Barack Obama's campaign manager for both elections.
Yeah, one of the best consultants in the Democratic side for years. And we would go out and run campaigns against each other for governors and congressmen and senators. But we were very good friends in real life. So we would talk politics a lot. We'd sneak off and have dinner once in a while and then go back to the campaign trail. People find that a little hard to understand, but we're all living in this parallel campaign universe.
And that is an interesting aspect of
politics, but he wasn't my enemy. In fact, he was a close friend. So
yeah, that happens. It's sort of like the sheep and the wolf in the old Warner Brothers car. Hi, Mac. Hi, Ted.
Tip O'Neill and Reagan. You know, it used to be that way. Excuse me one sec. I've got a little cold, and every time I sneeze, my wife like dives over the table.
Oh, I know. Every time we cough or sneeze in the house, it's immediately followed with, I got it. I have it.
Yeah, it's immediate. Sorry, just a cold, no fever. Fine. Yeah. So, make a long story longer here. We often, throughout our careers, even when he got beamed up and became the famous Obama guy, we would talk just politics, the art and rhythm of it on the phone lot. And he came up with the idea, said, why don't we turn this into a podcast? Because I'm on the board of the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago. I should also plug, I'm also co-director of the Center for the Political Future at USC here in LA. We have a great website you ought to check out. A lot of cool events on Zoom that anybody can tune into who's interested in politics. But anyway, so Axe and I started this podcast, two grizzled old campaign veterans talking about how the campaign really works, what's really going on. And we don't do R versus D because this year I'm taking a dive on the whole Trump thing. I want him to lose. But, you know, we really talk about how campaigns work, what it's like inside. We do the handicapper thing. So it's every week, Hacks on Tap.
That's what I like
too. So it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. What I like about it is a one, it is a non-hysterical political discussion. Two, it is like two baseball coaches talking about the World Series. You don't get into, you're evil if you don't believe this. It's like, this is what this guy needs to do to win. This is what he's doing that's going to give him a problem. This is what this guy might do to win. This is what he's going to do to have himself a problem. So it's refreshing, and it's a reminder of that at the end of the day, this is a competition.
Right. And we try to bring back a little of why people are attracted to politics, which is your opponent is not always your enemy. And, you know, the other thing is we're both in the cable TV racket. He's a big deal over at CNN, and I'm a fading star at NBC. And we've quite faded now.
That's where we met. We hang out at Catch a Fading Star in New York.
Right, right, exactly. The name used to ring out, I'll tell you. 1993, I owned that network. But one of the problems in that world, and believe me, I love my paycheck, I love my network, but they... you're sitting on a panel and you have 3 minutes to discuss the Electoral College, and half the time you're looking at the other people on the panel and you're like, what the hell have they done? You're a former Miss Oklahoma and you're a talk radio guy who set your ears on fire to protest, you know, gays in the military. So it's hard to have a smart, informed discussion of people who've actually been there and run big, big campaigns. So on Hacks on Tap, for good or for bad, we get to drone on forever with a lot of detail and stories and all that would never survive the stopwatch and the cut to the Ronco commercial rules of cable TV.
Yeah. And one of the reasons that I don't set my hair on fire every day about whatever Sean Hannity says or Rush Limbaugh or any of those people is because they wake up in the morning and they don't know what they think. You know, they have people like, you don't like this. You don't like, you know, I'm assuming that that's the way it is. I mean, Rush might be a little bit more, involved,
well, they kind of become conditioned. They're like the actor who gets beamed up from a soap opera to be on a popular cop show for 10 years. And by year seven, they're going out on weekends volunteering to help solve crimes. You know, they kind of start to think they're the thing. And look, I'll give Limbaugh, I've got a funny Limbaugh story if you want to hear it too.
Neither the time nor the place.
he does understand radio. As a broadcaster,
John Stone?
He's old school.
Wasn't he calling baseball games? Wasn't he an old rock and roll DJ?
All these Stone? Guys have been everything. I think Hannity was spinning the hot wax too, but I'll tell you my fast Rush Limbaugh story. Mm. So when I was doing a lot of Meet the Press, and you know, Limbaugh, like any radio guy, is, oh Christ, I got 4 hours. So he loves to have, you know, something he can bite and chew and kill 20 minutes. So once in a while he'd go nuts and I'd have a relative from back in Michigan call me up and say, hey, Rush was really beating you up. You know, you better know.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And I was always delighted. And it was always like Mike Murphy and his Georgetown cocktail party friends and their liberal, you know, it was a general Rush bit. So anyway, I send Limbaugh a note saying, listen, Rush, the last time I had a $400 bottle of wine at an effete restaurant in Georgetown, it was with you, because we all had dinner with Bill Bennett and some other people. And anyway, I think he had a sense of humor about it. But your point
is taken.
Yeah,
that was my question. If Limbaugh ragged you on his show and then saw you later that day at the airport, he wouldn't be like, argh. He'd be like, hey, Mike.
Yeah, no, it's pro wrestling. Hey, I think we're in Cleveland tomorrow. Remember, off the top rope, and then I'd spit on the Russian flag.
Yeah, exactly. You know. Yeah, that's what I tried.
It's a business.
Yeah, it's professional wrestling in suits and ties.
What I would say, though, is I believe all my shit, which is why I'm a little different than the average knucklehead on the punditry stuff, because I've been at it too long. I'm an old retired Republican general, done a lot of campaigns, proud to be conservative, a real conservative, Burkean conservative, not this populist shit we have now with Trump. And so I just say it on TV. And right. People don't like it, then they can change the channel or take up needlepoint. I don't care.
Yeah, well, yeah, and that is the thing is that it's been so – there's so much team sports element to it that, you know, people who say that they're conservative – but they have no idea what it means. That's the flag that the Trump team waves, so they say they're conservative, but they don't have any real conservative.
Yeah, they make a fetish out of it. I'm a real conservative. I think geometry is a red plot. No, conservatives are not for trade wars. We're for free trade. Conservatives don't destroy the federal budget without a control spending. Well, we're as bad as the Democrats now, you know, in the Republican Party. Conservatives believe and fought for the Atlantic Alliance, has kept the peace since 1945. Trump pisses all over NATO and our allies every day of the week. So no, we've got the stupid wing has taken over for a while because Trump speaks moron so well. But it'll cycle back, I think. And that'll be a noble fight after Trump within the party. What are we going to be now?
Yeah, and there's two wars in each party. There's the ascendant hysteria of the Trumpist aspect of the Republican Party, and the Never Trumpers, which are a ragtag band.
Oh no, exactly! It's the Devil's Brigade. I don't know how you guys are ever going to make it. The odds are impossible.
Yeah, but I'm also on the other side in the Democratic Party. There are there is the Bernie supporter and Satan's army. And I know, you know, I have a lot of friends that think like, you know, there was evil on this planet and it walked like a human being and its name was Al Gore.
He was the big problem.
Yeah. That the moderate wing of the Democratic Party is the root of all evil. And that was, in my unschooled opinion, my concern, they would not be able to then lead the party they were trying to destroy. And what you have with Trump is that happened.
Normally, there was always a third, and it's true of both parties, of the primary voters that are, you know, off in their own world. And the primary is about kind of beating them down, and then you try to organize behind the winner, and you go win the election, actually do something.
Barack Obama said it. The person who wins gets to do what they want, and don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. It's really simple, and that last one is the big, important one.
I'll reassure people who are worried about some Bernie revolt. Of the Bernie vote, the overwhelming majority of those primary voters will be behind Biden. One of the rules of politics, practical politics, is you don't really care when you're running a campaign if somebody goes in the voting booth and throws the lever and does a happy dance, or they throw the lever and say, oh, crap, I guess I got to do this, because a vote's a vote.
Right.
And I don't care how grumpy the Bernie people are as long as they cast a vote. And the overwhelming majority of them are habitual Democrats. They will vote against Trump. The people you hear it a lot about are kind of super vocal fringe. And the cable news media, they're in the conflict and noise business. You know, there's a P&L at the top of that equation. So they're going to give a lot more attention to the small sliver of the Bernie people who want to whine and complain and have their own kind of narcissism about politics, where it's really a reflection of how cool they are and how they don't fold to the man, blah, blah, blah. But in the end, the overwhelming amount of voters will vote in. If Joe Biden loses, it is unlikely it'll be because of the big Bernie vote didn't be for him. It'll be because some young voters and some African-American voters didn't show up, and because Trump, because of mistakes Biden makes. And again, I think it's more likely Biden wins. But if Biden really screws up, Trump will get the key vote of this election back, which is suburban, moderate to semi-conservative Republicans and independents, white college women, groups like that. The suburbs are what Trump lost. He's lost lots of little pieces. But the suburb was the big piece that Trump lost that has cost him so dearly, or cost the Republicans so dearly, in the 2018 elections, in the gubernatorial elections. It's been a wipeout. So if Trump can scare the suburbs back, he'll win. If not, he'll lose. And the election is much more hinged on that than a few disaffected Bernie activists who are loud on Twitter.
Yeah, and that is what people tend to forget is that you are listening to, you know, you're at a baseball game and two people in your section are arguing and the camera is pointed at them and people assume that your entire section is screaming at each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, exactly.
It doesn't work like that. And I think the thing that, and I don't want to belabor this because it's, we all understand it. I think one of the, and again, like it's not a layup that Biden wins, but I also feel that Democrats underestimated the antipathy towards Hillary Clinton in the general electorate. She had 30 years of negatives pounded into that brand and people just weren't buying. And I think a lot of people thought, and I know people thought like the presidency doesn't matter. It's a hood ornament on a truck. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
You know, and it didn't work out that way.
Yeah, that's one of the big lessons of the electorate. And some of us who kind of look at the engine room, American politics, and worry about systemic stuff, could see this one coming, which is politics began to have very low stakes. It was just another TV reality show. And, you know, we weren't in World War II. We weren't in Vietnam. We weren't in a huge recession. So people can get lazy and say, hey, I'm going to send the guy of clown shoes in there because I kind of hate politicians. You know, what the hell? It's only politics. Doesn't mean anything. Well, then you got a guy in clown shoes during a pandemic, and all of a sudden it means a lot. So I think the next election, people will be reacquainted with what their parents and grandparents who went through hard times in America know a lot about, which is an election having high stakes. And so I think there'll be a sobriety in the electorate going forward that's good news for Biden and bad news for Trump.
I think one of the lessons that people also learn from this, again, like you get two sides going to the extremes and you get the Grover Norquist element of the conservative party that, you know, the best government is a non-existent government. In this, we've learned that actually having a functional government is a pretty good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, government inherently is never, well, very rarely great at anything, but it has size and scope and it can be a unifying force. So even though it tends to stumble around, I mean, for all the love of Andrew Cuomo, they were late. New York kind of bungled this thing. Now, putting aside the federal bungle, which, of course, is the gold standard. But, you know, they got there. Here in California, and I've never been a huge Gavin Newsom fan, he just done an excellent job because he was early and quick and decisive. And what government can do that nobody else can do and say, okay, here's the plan, you know, maybe a little flawed, it may be a little imperfect, or improve it along the way, but now we're all going to move. Government has great power and scope to do that, which is why it's essential. Now, you know, I think one of the worst things Trump did was pretty much dismantle our early warning system for pandemics. And as we've all learned now, time is your only real weapon, trying to get in front of something like this and having time to get supplies and ramp up a supply chain and all that stuff. And, you know, we, through incompetence, if it's fair to argue, some would say 100 days, I'd say at least 60 days, have been lost, which has caused harm to the country. But, you know, here we are, and it's going to be a new world for about a year. Well, we hopefully get vaccines. And by the way, a vaccine within 12 to 16 months would be a huge breakthrough. We have new science, new tools. We might actually be able to do it. The good news, we're all saying, oh, that's too long. It's still almost miraculous if you look at the history of vaccine development.
Yeah. And that is, and it is interesting because you have, you know, big pharma, which is such a boogeyman to everyone. Yeah,
not so bad now, huh?
At the same time, we're like, you know, one thing you can say about the Death Star, it did show up on time.
Well, yeah, you know, that's what drove me crazy about Bernie at times, because Bernie's act was 20 minutes on Big Pharma, and then he has this huge cardiac condition, and a stent saves his life and allows him to do even a better, louder job of bashing pharma.
So I'm sure they're very
pharma
happy
is
about
imperfect,
it.
But there are a lot of people working 7 days a week round the clock in those labs right now. And so, you know, whenever anybody in politics promises you utopia, I'm just going to tell them they can't charge you anything anymore. I'm going to tell you life is free. I mean, the Bernie joke I use in speeches, because there's a real parallel to the Bernie world and the Trump world. They're both grievance candidates. You know, Trump says, oh, some Mexicans tunneled in here to go on a raping spree and take your job. I'm going to drop the hammer. I'm tough. Bernie is grievance, too. He says, look, I know you really, really wanted to get that PhD in aromatherapy candle making, but that's $400,000 in student loans. That's unfair. So there's a big room in New York and Wall Street where there's a guy in a Monopoly outfit with a top hat shoveling gold coins. I'm going to go there and take those profits so you don't have to pay anything and all your problems are solved. Well, whoever's pitching utopia like that is hustling you.
Yeah.
On either side.
I will say, I'll push back a little bit in defense of Bernie. Like, I think, you know, you get one guy on one hand going, you know, everybody should have health care. Everybody, you know, people should be treated well. People should be treated equal. There's an empathy towards the human condition in Bernie Sanders that I don't hear. And, you know, his main message is that Mexicans are rapists and they're here to kill your grandmother. But I do take your point that it is a lot of there is an evil force that is in charge of everything. And I'm the guy that can, you know, I have the one ring in charge of the others that can solve this problem.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I always say like,
yeah, no, look, and you're right about Trump. They're not morally equivalent. I mean, yeah. Bernie bashes corporations. Bernie's a demagogue. Elizabeth Warren, in my view, is a demagogue. Shame on all of them. But Trump's a racist. His grievance takes it to a whole new level of toxicity. I totally grant that point. It's one of the main reasons I'm such a vocal Trump opponent.
Yeah.
But Bernie, and to a somewhat lesser extent, and I'm sure send all your angry emails to Dana Gould at whatever, DanaGould.com. It's very easy in American politics now, and Trump has taught people to demagogue issues, say, all you got to do is vote for me and I'll pass a law to make all your problems go away and life will be free.
Yeah.
And somebody else is the problem and I'll punish them to make your life so easy. And it's a lie.
I liked Bernie. He wasn't my favorite candidate because I didn't think that he would appeal to a broad enough swath of the electorate to win. And I wanted to win. And but I thought, you know, I think his heart's in the right place. I also thought that he would, you know, get crushed in the gears of our bureaucracy. And, you know, we weren't going to have universal health care on January 6th. Their refusal to let people into their tent gave me pause on the entire thing. Like, what that told me was you don't know what you're doing.
Well, yeah, there was some of that. I'd like to see him put basic hair combing technology together before he tackles the Middle East. but look, I don't think Bernie's corrupt, though sometimes the wife, that's a whole nother podcast, but Bernie in his heart,
Cherchez la femme, my friend, Cherchez la femme.
I always liked it when Bernie got, this is always a great question with a real hardcore lefty. What about your six houses? The workers need leadership and I need rest to provide, you know, they get very touchy about the commissar's villa. But in his heart, I think Bernie is trying to help. I totally agree. My beef with him is much more policy and some of his political tactics, but compared to Trump, he's a speeding ticket, on the scale of the horribleness.
Is Donald Trump the worst president in American history?
Oh, easily. I mean, right now there's like a huge party going on, and depending on your proclivity, heaven or hell, with all the, you know, bad presidents high-fiving each other. Nixon's delighted. Herbert Hoover, like, yes, I'm off the list now. And Hoover got a bad rap, by the way, but that's a whole nother thing. How about Woodrow Wilson, who I personally think was a terrible president.
Well, he was an okay president. His wife was a terrible president.
Well, you know, the great burn on Wilson was, so here we are. It's after World War
One. By the way, just fun, my grandfather, Woodrow Wilson Steed, was named after Woodrow Wilson.
Oh, really?
And my grandfather was a cock. So go ahead.
Well, there you go. Well, he was just unctuous. And Colonel House, who actually was the president before Mrs. Wilson, was kind of an interesting cat. You can read about him. But anyway, so Wilson's there at the Paris Peace Conference, and you got the Brits and the French who've taken a million casualties, slaughtered a generation in the trenches, and the Germans too, for that matter. And so they're sitting there, and Wilson hopped in at the end of the war after some delaying. gets up there and starts to lecture them about his 14 points. And tough old Clemenceau, the Tiger of France, who was once they put a bullet in him during a speech an assassin did, and he kind of shrugged and continued the speech. He is rumored to have said, "When I die, bury me standing up facing Germany." But anyway, tough old Clemenceau had seen it all, and Lloyd George, they'd just been through the meat grinder listening to this guy, the 18-month, you know, end of the war victory lap guy, giving him the endless 14 points of democracy lecture. And Clemenceau turned to Lloyd George and says, "You know, Jesus Christ himself had only 10 points," which I always thought was a perfect Wilson put down. But I will say that Trump is without a doubt, he broke the scale. I mean, there's no comparing, because he is, we've had a few bumbling fools and mild incompetence, but he's venal, corrupt, totally incompetent. And the saddest thing is he does not understand what the job of president is. That we have this weird system where when you're in many democracies, you've got the head of state, the Queen of England, for example, and then you've got the head of government, the prime minister. In France, they have a president who's elected to be head of state, and the chamber deputies have a prime minister who handles the price of cheese and the daily squabbles of government, head of government. Well, the U.S., the president is the head of state and the head of government, which means that's where the whole presidential term came from. You're supposed to be kind of above the bullshit in times of national crisis. You're supposed to comfort the country. You're supposed to think about what's right for the country. And Trump doesn't understand any of that. He's still head of the Trump Organization. And that is such a warped view, it corrupts it.
Yeah, no, it's ironic in that you have to be an insane narcissist to think you can do the job, you know.
Oh, it helps. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's understandable. I mean, I get that, you know, insane narcissists are also movie stars and rock stars. I mean, like you.
And comedians.
And comedians. No, 100%. Yeah. Like I have, you know, my narcissism is the aspect of a human personality that I loathe in people the most. And the reason is because I know I am full of it and I have to keep it in check. Because my entire job is, as George Carlin said, my entire job is dig me.
Well, let me make you feel better, Dana. Let's talk about me some more.
Okay, good. But and so to
no,
that
no, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it is something that the good ones harness, but normal people don't want to do it, and normal people can't survive the process of being elected president of the United States.
Yeah, and but what you do is, so you're an insane narcissist to think, yeah, I could be the leader of the free world. I think that's a good job for me. But then you get the job, and it is not about you at all.
Right.
You know, you and that is the split screen that to me, what's the two things about Trump that are, there's a million things about Trump that are alarming. One, that he actually got elected. Two, he has, for an adult, absolutely no learning curve whatsoever. Six Watergates a day. Like, you know, Watergate took down Richard Nixon. Trump does six of those things a day. And just, you can't keep up with it. And that's where a lot of people on the left, that is the one conspiracy theory that I do ascribe to, is there's a thing that I know that they do it in Russia. They intentionally confuse people. They intentionally enrage people. They intentionally get people spinning in their grave or spinning in their heads in the hopes that they just throw their hands up and check out.
Oh, totally. There's a good book about that called, it was written about 8 or 9 years ago by a BBC guy who, you know, needed a job, so we wound up working internally in Russian news, and it's called "Where Nothing Is True and Everything Is Possible," or something like that. I'll give it to you for a clip, but it's a great book about that whole kind of Russian psychology of malleable truth and everything. But yeah, the creepy thing is people reward it. They're happier with that kind of world than you would think.
And does Donald Trump consciously ascribe to that, or is that just a beautiful,
you know,
coincidence?
There are so many theories, and I'm not qualified to diagnose Trump, but I would say I think Trump's narcissism is so strong that half the lies he repeats he believes to be true, because he has the ability to create his own internal reality. And he thinks he's doing a good job on the virus. He thinks they're out to get him and it's bad for the country. You know, I think he's able to create that, which is why he's so dedicated to his disconnection with reality. I feel sorry for the guy, you know, and he's, I'll be glad to see him go, but I don't think he's a particularly healthy individual mentally.
Oh, no, no. He's and I don't know how he does go. I mean, the theory is, you know, if he does lose, he won't accept the loss. And it will literally just be one of those things where they swear in Joe Biden, Trump will not be there. And then the Secret Service will have to move Biden into the building.
Half those agents would love to put the flying hammer lock on Trump and bounce him out. He's kind of an abusive guy. But no, no, he'll go, but publicly he'll say things to undermine the institution, that it was ripped off, the Democrats bust in voters. You know, he'll go to his crazy fiction. You know, to your earlier point, this is going to be the weirdest reference ever made, which is saying something on this,
for this podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
We've already got a half an hour without mentioning Bela Lugosi meets a Brooklyn gorilla, so it's already a record.
a great picture, by the way. Well, this is in that vein. People often ask me what these guys are really like, the personalities. And I saw a bad movie on a plane that really struck me. And it's a great acting. It's not a good movie. But if you want to know what presidents are like after they get out of office, in the great classic Ray Romano film, Welcome to Mooseport, Gene Hackman plays a recently out of office president. And the premise is he's moving to the small town and raised the Everman, and they wind up running for city council together. Well, one, Hackman is always is actually terrific in an underwritten part. But if you want to know what a former president is like, my God, it's dead on perfect. The guy Hackman plays exactly the way they all are, at least a couple that I've known. And it's a mix of kind of public spiritedness and narcissism. They have to constantly beat back with a hammer. And I thought, wow, this thing, I don't know who wrote it or whatever, but they've been around a former president. So I'll just flag that for your nerdiest cinephile / political junkies, that go check out Welcome to Mooseport.
And there's also, I will check that out,
presidents are like.
There's also a film called My Fellow Americans, where James Garner and Jack Lemmon.
Yeah.
That also stars a doe-eyed young ingenue named Dana Gould, who gets who delivers a sandwich to Jack Lemmon, and the Secret Service think I'm an assassin. And that's how I ended up spending 3 days with James Garner and Jack Lemmon.
Beyond the electric moment of your performance, what was it like on set with Lemon?
I ended up spending 3 days hanging out with James Garner and Jack Lemon because it was our scene at a book fair. And I'm so eternally grateful that by the time I got that job, I knew to shut up and listen to people and ask them questions about them. You know, like, I knew how to sit with James Garner and Jack Lemon.
Right.
So that eventually I could talk to them. Like, I spent the entire first day just kind of chilling out. Second day, kind of opened up a little thing. And then by the third day, we were like, hey, Jack, hey, what are you doing? You're going over here? It was amazing. And I might have told this story on the podcast before. I'm sure Colonel Fox will flag it. But yeah, I get to that. Like, Jack Lemmon would, hello, love. You know, he would just come in, lovely. And James Garner had a director's chair made out of saddle leather that had been given to him as a gift by, I think, the Rockford Files crew. Like, he was, you know, very popular with the crew, which is a good sign. And he was talking about being in Bruce Lee's dojo in 68-69. And he goes, now I was in there. It was me. It was R.J. Wagner, Jimmy Coburn, a couple of guys. And I'm sitting there like all eyes, you know.
Yeah, just, totally. Sure. I've always thought Gardner's massively underrated. I'm a huge fan.
Huge guy. And just Jimmy Coburn. I just love Jimmy Coburn. I remember I was on the set of Tropic Thunder, and Nick Nolte jumps in the mud and, you know, hits the button for this explosion towards the end of the movie. And when he finished it, I said to him, I said, that was very Who'll Stop the Rain, which was a movie he made in the late 70s. And he just goes, yeah, or Harry Ford. Like, Harry? Oh, Harrison Ford.
Yeah, right.
But to him, it's Harry Ford.
I was just telling that story to Bobby De Niro.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So Garner tells the story, goes, so we were in this dojo with Bruce Lee. And it's R.J. Wagner, Jimmy Coburn, me, a couple of guys. And Bruce was sparring with this guy, black guy, was like a kickboxing, Olympic kickboxer guy, you know, tough. And he, I don't know what he did, but he did something. And Bruce stopped and said, "You only get one of those." Well, he must have did it again. And Bruce put him down. It was just amazing. It was just like, he must have did it again. Yeah. And there's another story about James Garner punching Glenn Larson in the face once because of a contract dispute over the rock.
Visit our concession and see for yourself the delicious treats, drinks, and snacks awaiting you. If you are thirsty, try ice-cold soft drinks or a cup of hot, flavorful coffee. Get something to go with it, like a sizzling and satisfying hot dog or a tasty, tender sandwich. Try one of these delicious treats, and you'll be back at the concession for more before the show is over. The service at our concession is friendly and efficient.
They're true tales from Weirdsville. Tales from Weirdsville. And they're true.
Can your heart stand the shocking facts?
All of the things that have been going on in our society and our culture can be summed up in two words: radical change. But it's true. Cultures change radically all the time. So what happens when an entire modern culture goes completely tits up and needs to be rebuilt from the ground up? Let's look at Germany in 1945. World War II was over, and Germany, who started it, had lost. Now, aside from the people that the army and the Nazi regime had murdered, nearly 9% of the indigenous population had been killed. Virtually all of Germany's major cities had been bombed into rubble. Agricultural production, important if you want to eat, was down to 35% of what it was before the start of the war. Daily life for the average German citizen was scavenging through rubble, in poverty, hunger, and misery. The daily goal was to avoid freezing or starving to death. At the Potsdam Conference, the Allies ceded 25% of Germany's territory to Poland and the Soviet Union. The people who lived in those territories, as well as the Germans who lived in the Sudetenland or the Czech Republic, they all had to leave. There are reports that over 1 million people died on their way into Germany from illness and starvation. Those that survived caused the population of Germany to swell. In Germany itself, the major cities, specifically, food was scarce, power was scarce, money was useless. The civilian population was dependent on the goodwill and the largesse of an army they were, until quite recently, trying very hard to kill. But to rebuild a country, you need raw materials and construction equipment. But every factory in Germany had been bombed out of existence. It was quite literally a concrete jungle. Now, the Allies were faced with a dilemma: how to rebuild Germany. And first and foremost in their mind, as they wondered how to deal with Germany in the aftermath of World War II, was how they fucked up dealing with Germany in the aftermath of World War I. The Treaty of Versailles after World War I placed all the blame for hostilities squarely on Germany, forced it to surrender vast amounts of territories, as well as colonies in China, Africa, and the Pacific. Additionally, it was forced to pay back billions in reparations. Now, fair or not, it crippled the country and led to a set of circumstances: economic hardship, cultural victimization, festering societal anger that set the table for a fanatical demagogue like Adolf Hitler to rise to power. How? By picking out a scapegoat and promising to make Germany great again. Now, there are some who say that the Treaty of Versailles was also instrumental in the stock market crash of 1929, but that's another story, and it sounds, if you ask me, like a very boring one. And so you would think that at the end of World War II, chastened by their early mistake, the Allies would not repeat it. Want to bet? Initially, the Potsdam Conference concluded with the plan of converting Germany into a solely pastoral and agricultural nation, with no military and only very light industry. Additionally, the entirety of Germany's educated professional class was being looted from the country in mad grabs by both the United States and the Soviet Union. Scientists, engineers, anybody in a white coat was grabbed up off the streets and whisked off to either Minsk or Alamogordo, New Mexico, depending on who got to you first. Now, this story was told at length in the True Tales episode Operation Paperclip, which can be found in the December 2018 episode Post-Hallowgiving. The biggest mess of all was the capital city of Berlin. In the immediate aftermath of the war, the country of Germany was split in half, with the Soviet Union controlling the eastern half and the Allies controlling the western half. But 100 miles inside the Soviet-controlled eastern half lie the capital city of Berlin, which itself was divided into four occupation zones. Basically, the armies of the Soviet Union, United States, France, and the United Kingdom. And wherever those armies were, they controlled that zone. So even though Berlin was inside the Soviet half of Germany, the Allies controlled half the city, and the only way to get to Berlin was the Autobahn, the federally controlled highway that ran between the two sectors. But here's the thing. At this point, in 1945, right after the war, the Allies were still not 100% sure there was even still going to be a Germany. But as the post-war world began to take shape, events would dictate a radically different course of action. To begin with, denazification worked quickly and well, and the Cold War happened. The Soviet Union tightened its grip on all of Eastern Europe and made no bones about its intent to remake the globe in its own communist image. With Berlin split down the middle, 100 miles inside Eastern Germany, the city became the front line in a global ideological struggle. Additionally, it became readily apparent that Western Europe needed Germany's economy to fully recover. It was not until 1947 that the Marshall Plan pumped about $13 billion into the German economy. Today, that's about $140 billion. In 1948, the Western Allies introduced the Deutschmark as the new currency of West Germany. This replaced the Reichmark, which was the money under Hitler. But this included West Berlin. Now, having a free Western currency at play inside its borders was the last straw for the Soviet controllers of East Germany, and a blockade was established that cut off access to West Berlin by the Allies. In a classic case of not knowing your enemy, the Soviet Union felt that the West would not have the stomach for the fight, and eventually would cede all of Berlin to the Soviet Union. Well, they guessed wrong. On June 24th, 1948, the Soviets severed all land and water connections between the Free West and Berlin. The same day, they blocked all road and rail access out of West Berlin. The next day, June 25th, the Soviets stopped supplying food to the citizens of West Berlin. West Berlin only had about 1 month's worth of food. Now, a military option was out of the question. Allied forces had disbanded after the war. Everybody was home, going to college, making babies, getting ready for the 50s. There were forces in West Germany, obviously, but vastly reduced, and no match for the overwhelming army the Soviets could have quickly mounted. As far as pulling another Hiroshima, and it was discussed, but there were only about 50 operational nuclear devices available to the United States at that time, and our Air Force was not prepared to deliver them. This was a classic standoff. The Soviet Union believed that the Allies did not want to start a war, and they felt that they could get what they want if they provoked one anyway. The Allies felt the Soviet Union did not want to start a war and be responsible for World War III, but they had to stand by their intent of a free West Berlin. Now, there was one person, the head of the U.S. Air Forces in Europe, General Curtis D. LeMay.
Now, Curtis D. LeMay is the man that George C. Scott is basically playing in Dr. Strangelove. Buck Turgidson is Curtis D. LeMay. He thought we should go all in, balls out, with B-29s attacking Soviet air bases while our ground forces stormed Berlin. His plan was vetoed in favor of something not completely batshit crazy. Thank God for small favors. The solution to save West Berlin was both simple and incredibly difficult. If the Allies could not access West Berlin by the ground, they could do it by air. There were 2 million free people living in West Berlin. It was calculated that 1,500 tons of food and 3,500 tons of fuel and supplies would be needed to be flown into Berlin each day. Now, the Berlin airlift, as it came to be known, took a while to get up to speed. By the end of the first week, they had only managed to move 90 tons. By the end of the second, only 1,000. The endeavor was ridiculed in the communist press as the West's pathetic attempt to maintain their untenable position in Berlin. It took 2 full months to adapt and tweak and rework the process until it finally achieved its goal of airlifting 5,000 tons of food and supply into the western half of Berlin every day. One day, a pilot named Gail Halverson landed his C-54, and while it was being unloaded, he decided to stroll over to a group of German children who were clustered at the end of the runway watching the planes come in. He gave the group of kids all the candy he had on him, 2 sticks of gum, and then watched, astonished, as the kids calmly divided the gum up between them as best as they could, and then passed the wrapper around to the kids who were left out so they could at least get a smell. No fighting, no screaming. Halverson was astonished. He told the kids that on his next flight in, he'd bring them more candy. And when they asked him how they would know it was him, he said, "I'll wiggle my wings." The next day, on his approach, he rocked his wings and dropped some candy bars attached to little parachutes made out of handkerchiefs out to the children waiting below. Every day after that, the number of children increased, and he made several more drops. Soon, there was a stack of mail at the base of operations addressed to Uncle Wiggly Wings. His simple act of kindness was officially expanded into Operation Little Vittles. And all of the pilots were soon dropping candy bars and gum out of their planes on tiny parachutes. American children donated candy bars of their own to the effort. German children christened the candy-dropping aircraft Raisin Bombers. And that now, as you know, is the name of a very popular sex move. I'm kidding. The Berlin airlift lasted until May of 1949, when Stalin, convinced that the Allies had no intentions of abandoning West Berlin, finally lifted the blockade. The division of East and West Berlin was the testament to its aftermath. The city and the country would remain divided until the fall of the Soviet Union. The Berlin Wall came down on November 9th, 1989. Berlin, a city utterly destroyed, had finally become whole again. Now, there are a lot of amazing books and documentaries about the divided city of Berlin. I'm going to tell you 3 of my favorites. Michael Caine is Harry Palmer in Funeral in Berlin, a taut and funny Cold War thriller directed by Guy Hamilton, who directed Goldfinger, set in Berlin in 1966. Great movie. Wim Wenders' Wings of Desire, which is a gorgeous romantic fantasy set in West Berlin that was made in 1987, and the film tells the story of a group of angels who live in Berlin and listen to the troubles of the people who live and work there. Specifically focusing on the story of a young man played by Bruno Ganz who falls in love with a ballerina. It's just gorgeous. Wings of Desire. I think it was remade in an American version with Nicolas Cage. Don't see it. See the original. Lastly, there is a great German film from 2006 called The Lives of Others, and that tells the story of an East German Stasi agent who is ordered to spy on a playwright. Now, this is a really by-the-book, by-the-numbers East German secret policeman. but he learns that the only reason his superiors want him to put this guy under surveillance is because one of his bosses is interested in the guy's girlfriend, and it causes him to question everything he is. All of these movies are great. I assume they're on Netflix or iTunes. Funeral in Berlin, you might have to get on DVD. But if you find yourself on your way to Amazon, make sure you go there through the Amazon banner at danagould.com. You get what you want, we get a few shekels here, kicked in to help us keep the lights on. Yep, we ain't commies. We want money.
And now, on with the show.
I do wonder what these... the great story of the ex-presidents, it's a fascinating... You know, what is it like to wake up, to be the leader of the free world, and then to wake up and not be the leader of the free world? And the stories about Lyndon Johnson on his ranch.
Yeah, going out of his
like
mind.
Having meetings in the morning. We got to mend this fence down there. And it's also interesting that, you know, Johnson... By the way, like in terms of like presidents being crazy, Trump is not the first president we've had that was crazy.
Yeah, but the others knew how to harness or at least keep a rope. I mean, look, Nixon would get a little bombed and wander around the White House at night.
Oh, Nixon and Johnson were both out of their skulls.
Yeah. But they knew the boundaries of it. I mean, you know, if Trump
and they
Nixon,
both and they both loved the country, they both
machine gun.
Yeah, and misguided, albeit at times. They love the country more than themselves. And I don't think you could say that about Donald Trump.
Not at all. At all.
And Johnson, like, you know, Johnson died not long after leaving office. Like, he couldn't function after he lost that, after he left that office.
Well, it's an addictive velocity. I mean, it's obviously nowhere near equivalent. But you talk to anybody in the campaign business or candidates, you go from this bubble that's moving at 1,000 miles an hour. All right, your 757 is ready. We got 8 stops and live 60 minutes at midnight. Then we're going to, you know, you're hurtling through space, no sleep. You're running on caffeine. There's pressure. You know, people are having affairs. It's just this crazy thing. And then one day they fire a starter gun and you lost or you won. If you won, you get into a new bubble. If you lost, you literally go home and it's over. And the campaign people all say, oh, God, I'm ready for sleep. So people sleep for 18 hours and then they go into a massive depression because there's none of the every day, the polling at 5 a.m., the this, the that, the incredible resources, it all goes away. And, you know, they're sitting there pushing a grocery cart somewhere under fluorescent light, listening to Muzak. And it's hard. People get very depressed.
You're good friends with David Axelrod. David Axelrod is good friends with Barack Obama. They must have had some post-office adjustment.
Oh, I think so.
And he seems pretty buttoned down. I mean, the interesting thing about Barack Obama is that he is Spock. he's not Kirk. He's Spock.
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of stretch the analogy, a prime directive that once you've been president, you get out of the daily meddling. That'll be another problem with Trump because he won't.
Yeah,
And you go off into other things, and these are high-energy people. So I'll cure malaria, they find stuff, but nothing's the same. And, you know, David was smart about it, though. He decided he didn't want to be a for-hire guy for the most part, so he started this impressive organization at the University of Chicago, the Institute of Politics, and he spends a lot of time on that. And I think he really enjoys being a commentator on CNN. And, you know, look, we're both on the Chautauqua tent circuit where we do speeches for money, which is fun. You know, it's like being a stand-up where you're not required to get a lot of laughs. They pay you. The audience is great.
Must be nice.
I fake it by being funnier than average. And, you know, all of a sudden they think I'm Robin Williams. But, you know, you're out there at the Outboard Motor Association. You do your 45 minutes. They're nice to you, and they give you a big check, and then you leave. In fact, one of the hardest things about this little Satan bug moment we're having right now is all of us in that racket. And, you know, it's just like in Ed Wood. People think I can tell the future because I wear a tuxedo on TV. Well, it's similar. Right. They've seen you on TV, so they book you in. But all that's gone now. And so normally there's a lot of grousing in the ranks of us political windbags, because right now we'd normally be on our way to the American Silverware Association in Vegas to do an event and then the Bail Bond League, and, you know, and it's good money. So we're all, you know, it's hurting us too. We're all sacrificing.
But
that's the other part, and Axe does plenty of that. Sometimes we even do it together.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sympathetic to the people that want to, you know, it's like the economy is not designed to just be stopped for 3 months.
Yeah.
I am sympathetic to that. And, you know, I lost a buttload of money in bookings and stuff like that, you know, and there's the cautious optimism that we can reopen and get about our business slowly, but there's the fear of, are we just opening the door to a worse second wave, like the 1918 Spanish flu?
Yeah, it is. But let me tell you something, Dana, unlike so many of the liberal snowflakes and sky is falling crowd now, I believe in a little thing called America, American sturdiness, American robustness, and the fact that we can really handle this thing, which is why I'm coming to you now from my Zoom studio in Auckland, New Zealand, because I bugged out on December 13th with a pile of gold bars the minute I saw the president would have to handle this thing. But I'm sure you guys back there will.
The event.
Yes, exactly. And just parenthetically, that was a joke. Of course, I'm here in L.A. with
You're in Main Street, USA.
That's right. Well, we're
Los Angeles, California.
This thing is bad, and every time somebody dies prematurely, it's a tragedy. But I've got to, and again, I'm a longtime critic of a lot of California government, but our numbers are, you know, our fatality rate in LA County, I think right now is running around, I should check this because this number dances every day, but a couple dozen people per 100,000. You know, we have 10 million people in this county, so we're in much better shape. We just have to keep it that way than New York, New Jersey, Michigan, Louisiana, some of the states that have had 10x our fatality rate. But yeah, that'll take social distancing, and people don't like, as your own Tinder count will demonstrate, people don't like to people don't like to be sparks coming off your phone. I know that
it's my Grindr account, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't meet any girls on Grindr. I don't see when I survey the news, like the state numbers, and I always look at these states like Georgia and Michigan that are reopening, and Vegas, which is a city, that are reopening early, and because I don't know if they're in an economic panic or if it's just cultural identity that the government is saying don't go out, so they feel the need to go out, which is human nature and a big part of the American the fake American identity of, you know, anything the government tells you is evil, but we all stop at red lights, which is a government plot to control traffic.
Tell me about it. Luckily, my tinfoil hat allows me to avoid those control rays.
Yeah, you do need rules. Are those states being punished for that, or are the numbers basically the same whether you do that or not, is the question?
It's a tremendous question because a lot of things are going on. It's not as simple as the cartoon of red state yokels are running around rubbing each other to kill the species versus – so first of all, it's naturally politically polarized for two reasons. One is our country's obviously polarized, but if you look at the U.S., there are about 3,200 counties. And if you look at Trump versus Hillary, even though Hillary won the popular vote by a little under 3 million votes, she got the overwhelming bulk of her vote from only 200 counties of the 3,200. So in those huge mega counties, L.A. County, Alameda County up in San Francisco, et cetera, it's very blue, dark blue. And because those places have the most population density and they're on the coast for the most part, they've taken the hardest hit from the virus. So if you're in blue state America, everybody you know is blue state, like LA County, there's more concern. If you're in New York in particular, you know people who've died unnecessarily from this. But meanwhile, in those sparser, smaller population rural counties that tend to be very red, you don't know anybody who's sick or very few people. Now, there are exceptions, the clusters around some meatpacking plants in Iowa and South Dakota. But for the most part, in your life, you're not feeling the disease pain day to day. You are feeling the economic pain. And so that has led to kind of this pushback of, wait a minute, why are you shutting us down when in our county there are three cases out of 50,000 people? Now, the one problem with that is we don't really know how many cases there are because we don't have enough testing. Testing is harder. People say, why can't you get a test? Why is it? Testing is hard, and it takes a while to ramp it up because it's a complicated DNA test. The test to find out if you have the antibodies in your blood is a pretty simple test, and we can have a lot of those, and eventually that'll be very helpful if this thing doesn't come back.
Yeah, a friend of mine tested for the antibody.
Right. That's a very low-tech blood test, easy to mass produce.
But they did not know that they had had it.
Right, because we think, and again, we're trying to learn fast, and we have the best medicine in the history of the planet right now, technologically, is if you're asymptomatic, can you still spread it? Probably. How many people are asymptomatic? So right now, to get tested, you have to go ask, because there aren't enough tests. You have to show symptoms of fever.
Right.
So the numbers are bigger than we think. But in more rural and exurban America, they're feeling the economic pain more than the disease pain. In New York or New Jersey or Boston, all blue, all dense population, all having real trouble. Detroit, Chicago, New Orleans, they are feeling the disease pain as much or more than the economic pain. So that's why, you know, and then cable TV rolls in and they say, find me a fat guy in Michigan with a machine gun hovering around the state capitol. And they paint all the protesters as that. I think if you own a hardware store in Odison, Iowa, and you've got a very low disease rate and you're a good person who paid your taxes, fought in the Iraq war in the reserves, and there's nothing wrong with you, and your life's work is going to be wiped out economically, and you're saying, can't we open and stay 6 feet apart and kind of work with this because we're not particularly hard hit here? I don't think you're an asshole for asking that question and voicing that pushback politically. So it's just a little more complicated. If we had massive testing, then we could manage the comeback even better. But some states are starting to creep back, and you know, we're have ebbs and throws. This thing never goes away till there's a good vaccine. The whole idea is to keep it at
and then
a
the
low,
vaccine has
rate
to be
for a long time.
Yeah, and then once there's a vaccine, we need to, you know, then you need to manufacture 300 million shots.
Big problem. Yeah, because so people say, well, why doesn't the government fix it?
Are they gearing up for that yet?
Well, so here's
they
the
not
problem.
Be?
They are, but, you know, again, we're late. But there's a public policy program. So if you're Pfizer and you build a facility that can make in 6 weeks, you know, 20 million vaccines, you're going to lose your shirt on it because it's going to spend 5 years sitting empty till a moment like this. So it's not something the private sector can really do to build like a couple of plants for massive surge in a vaccine for a pandemic every 7 years. So if we'd had a time machine and 8 months ago, you know, Senator Gould said, hey, I have an idea. Let's spend $500 billion on a string of 7 vaccine plants for the surge for a pandemic. Okay, what are we going to cut? Well, we're going to cut, you know, help for tuition. Fuck no. We're going to cut defense. Fuck no. We're going to raise your taxes. Kill you. And so politics does not reward advanced planning because most domestic budget politics are fighting over a pie where everybody has a good reason to ask for their slice.
Yeah,
Bernie will say, well, you just got to tax rich. Well, you can tax rich people, millionaires, at 110% of their wealth. So not only do you take everything they make, you fine them another 10%, which I'm sure AOC would do a cartwheel for, but that isn't enough money. That wouldn't pay our federal budget problems. So, you know, it's a really hard thing. So what will happen now is we will boost production as fast as possible. I tweeted at Murphy Mike a good link to a couple of pretty smart scientists about how to globally do this, to integrate the pharmaceutical manufacturers with government to try to surge production and get in front of this. But it's a really tough public policy program. It'll be done, but it'll be done sloppy, late, and expensive, which is the only option we have because we never do things preemptively smart and expensive because politics won't pay for that.
And I don't think it's specific to America, but it certainly applies to America. The great Winston Churchill quote of, you know, you can always count on America to do the right thing after it's exhausted every other possibility.
Right. Well, you know, it's like a war. You generally go out and lose the first year worth of battles. Your planes don't work. You don't have enough of them. And then, you know, through an expensive expenditure of lives and treasure, you eventually get good at it.
Right. Yeah, no, that's true. And here's my last question before I send you off, because you're a student of history and I pretend I am. You know, I scratch my head at, you know, the people that, you know, there's this small lunatic fringe, the whole thing's a fake, it's all a conspiracy, birds are robots, blah, 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 blah. But there's always been that voice. I mean, there were voices in America against America's involvement in World War II that, you know, we had to, you know, we didn't get it. We didn't join into the obvious war that was coming until they literally brought it to us. And even I'm assuming, and this is the question, like during the war, I'm assuming there were still swaths of the American public that wanted nothing to do with it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Even the New York Times was a little slow to the cause.
Yeah.
You read the New York Times coverage of the Berlin Olympics, it's like, one can only marvel at German efficiency, you know. I'm sure that file cabinet in the archives is going to disappear one day because it's pretty hilarious. If you go to MikeMurphyCommentary.com, it's an old dusty website with some opinion stuff I wrote back in the 90s. I think there's a Weekly Standard article where I went after the New York Times for being soft in the pre-war days, at least in their reporting for a while. But yeah, your point is well taken.
Yeah, that's and it's comforting. Like, you know, it's like whatever is awful about now has always been here. We've always had it.
And, yeah, it's people. You know, it's people. I mean, you know, the founding fathers, when they wrote the original blueprint, which of course has to be updated as the world evolves, but they were standing around watching, you know, knife fights in taverns among drunks and said, So Franklin Hamlin, who are we going to let vote here? These idiots? And so the Senate was designed to never be anywhere near a voter. You know, it was going to be appointed by legislators. So it had like 9 levels of protection. The Senate was there to keep the drunken rabble from controlling the country. And then the House was designed to be the drunken rabble every 2 years. But, you know, white men with property could vote. They were terrified of, you know, the Jerry Springer school of vox populi. And now now we have a much more democratic system.
The common clay.
Right. People do. But, you know, people got to take this seriously because people have so much power, unprecedented in the whole length of American history, to be able to influence the people. But if, you know, you're going to be a clapping seal voting for a fish, then you kind of get what you deserve.
All right. Let's end it there.
upbeat kind of. I'm going to go wash my hands now and try to forget. But you be well in this pandemic, pal.
I will say we'll stay in touch, and God willing, soon we'll catch a movie at some point.
Oh,
drive-in is open.
It's still open. I know we've talked about that. That could be that could be pretty cool. Can I do some final plugs here?
Please do. Yes,
you can edit them out, but I can tell the guys I did.
If you want to keep up with me,
it's at Murphy Mike or Hacks on Tap with David Axelrod every week on all your podcast programs. And check out, if you're here in LA, the Center for the Political Future. We're on Twitter. We're on the interweb for the kids at USC, because we can't do our normal stuff in this pandemic hell. We're doing a lot on virtual things, including a longtime Democrat brawler, political consultant, Bob Shrum, who directs the center, and I on Zoom talking politics about what's really going on. So we're a big resource here in Los Angeles. We just need people to hear about it. So, Dana, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and Hacks on Tap. It is good to hear opinions that don't always align with yours, as long as they are smart and informed.
It's good for me. I find myself occasionally grunting assent. Hard for an old Reagan guy. All right, you be safe, pal. Always fun to do your fantastic podcast.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, see ya.
Bye.
Other podcasts reach for the sky. Dana Goldbauer.
We barely try.
This has been the Dana Gould Hour, brought to you by The Internet. Music by Andy Paley, with Jake Posner behind the board. Produced by Jeff Fox. Graphic design and web production by Spencer Hunt and Segan Friend. Sound editing and post-production by Jalinda Palmer and Joe Napolitano.
Hey, if you like the show, why don't you drop us a line at show@danagould.com. Tom Kenny speaking.
I'm a person. I'm a singer. I love to sing and DJ. Boom. Pizza. You want me? Pizza. Boom.